and welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Chris Shunk, and as always, we have Dan Roth with us today. Dan, what's going on?
It's a little chilly in New England tonight.
And we've got Sam Abul Salmon. Sam, what's going on?
Hey, it's a beautiful day in Michigan today.
Yeah, we're feeling pretty good over here.
You suck.
Well, good weather's coming your way. We'll pass it by Thursday or something. All right, we've got one of our favorite podcasts that we do is when we answer all questions pretty much the entire time. We'll cover a couple of small-time news items, but nothing huge. And then we'll skip right into the questions and keep getting them until we've got them all done. So check with John, and we've got all the questions. And first, we'll check out the Autoblog Garage. Sam, what do you have?
Just got an Audi A6 3.0T today, which is a slight misnomer since it's not actually turbocharged, but supercharged. It's got the same supercharged 3-liter V6 that's coming in the new Audi S4 in the next few months.
Well, and the T is for touring, right?
I don't know what it's supposed to be for.
They're just keeping the naming convention the same, right?
Yeah, well, they call it a TFSI, which is the same as their turbocharged direct injected engines. So, well, technically, you know, a turbocharger is a type of supercharger, so they're kind of interchangeable. So, anyway, but regardless of what you call it, it's a nice car. It's pretty big. It didn't occur to me last week when I was driving the new MKS, Lincoln MKS, with the EcoBoost engine, but this is actually probably a more direct competitor to it than any of the cars that Ford actually had on hand at their proving ground for that drive, which were all V8 powered Japanese and American luxury cars like the Infiniti M45 and the Cadillac STS.
Now, how much is the A6 stickering for? What, 68,000? Something outrageous?
No, actually, this particular one was...
No, it's a reasonable 52, huh?
Well, and how much was the MKS that you drove at for Ford?
They didn't give us a precise sticker on it, but I think the base price on the MKS with EcoBoost, I think, is like 47,000.
So it is extremely close.
Yeah, it's actually quite close. So it's not bad at all. Of course, you know, the Audi doesn't have Ford's nav and sync system, you know, which, you know, is worth at least $5,000 premium, but...
Well, they charge two.
Yeah.
Right, but MBD's saying versus what they have.
It's worth $5,000 more than anything Audi can offer.
Well, is it standard in the MKS, too? Because I'm assuming something like MMI is actually optional in the Audi, even at that price point.
The nav system, the MMI interface, I think, is standard on the Audi, but I'm not sure system is. I don't have the Monroney handy here, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is... Yeah, it's not horrible, but it's not. It's certainly not on a par with Ford's system.
You know, that's what I think is great. You know, we can sit here and go, "Yeah, I've got the Audi, and it's a marvelous car." But that nav system—it's no Ford. I think that's awesome. Because I mean, I've got the Edge Sport still, and the nav in that. I mean, I paired it with my phone, and everything is great. It's fantastic. Well,
the beauty is that you can get that very same system, you know, in a $20,000 Mustang or Fusion. You know, in addition to a $50,000 Lincoln, so you know that's the great thing about it.
Yeah,
if Americans have proved one thing, they've proven that they can do navigation better than anybody else. Because even if you get into a Chrysler and you think, you look at the nav screen, it's this little 6-inch unit, and it looks like it's malnutrition versus some of the navs that they've got coming out. But it's so easy to use. In 3 seconds, you are paired up. You're ready to go. I mean, simple and straightforward is the win. I mean, that's when you're talking about the average consumer, you know, stepping into a car for the first time, they don't want to have headaches. It's going to give them a bad first impression of the car.
Yeah, well, it's simple, but it's not that it's not capable either. So that's the nice part, is that the Ford system, it's nice that you can get a system that good on a $20,000 car. It's not like the Ford system in the $50,000 car is any kind of a penalty. It's more like a value in the cheaper cars because it is so good.
And for you sitting at home right now thinking, I got to write these guys and say they're being Ford fanboys, you're kind of...
Try it. Go try it.
You're winning this time because we start talking about the Audi and then it's a Ford conversation.
Go down to a dealer, take a test drive in a car that's got the system in there, and then go to an Audi dealer or a BMW dealer and try out MMI or iDrive. and tell us which one you think is better. Yeah.
And then write us and tell us.
Yeah, and you know, iDrive, actually, I had the 128, which had the improved iDrive. It's better. By leaps and bounds, it's better, but it's still nowhere near as friendly as it should be.
You know, Dan, you know what you should do? And you know how, like, they do, like, Motor Trend has the, you know, where are you reading Motor Trend, or is that Car and Driver, one of the two, and they take pictures in front of the Eiffel Tower and stuff like that. We should get them to do a where are you when you're doing, when you're listening to the podcast, and take a picture of that.
We get an awful lot of pictures of toilets.
Look, if you're listening to one of these hour and five minute deals.
I think that might be one of those questions that we don't really want to know the answer to.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.
I bet these guys would get creative enough to put together a gallery that's worth looking at. And then John won't schedule the podcast for 15 minutes before and 15 minutes after something else. It'll get its own 30-minute time slot if we actually have a good pictures for it. It would be a riot. I would love it. So guys, just do it. Send it to us at...
That would be cool. Or actually, you know,
podcast
somebody,
at autoblog.com.
No, somebody make a Flickr pool or something. Send us a link.
Sounds good. Autoblog podcast Flickr pool.
Right, but for now, do the picture thing, because I'm not so sure about the Flickr pool. All right. all right, let's move on. Dan, what'd you have? You got the Edge still, right?
Edge Sport till tomorrow, and it's good enough that it has made me start poking around and looking for what kind of deal I can get on an Edge. Not an Edge Sport, as much as I like it, the 22-inch wheels are... not really my taste. Polished aluminum with very expensive tires on them.
You just get a gold tooth to match it, so you can't afford that.
I mean, you know, it rides really well. It rides and handles well, surprisingly well, because you look at that rubber and you just go, oh, that's going to be rough. But it's not. It's fine. At least I think it's fine. I don't have any complaints about the way the Edge rides, even the regular Edge. And I know some people think it's harsh. I don't share that opinion. I love the interior. I love the way it looks. The Edge Sport, you know, it's just, I mean...
What about the hideous dashboard? That dashboard with all those lines in it?
I don't find the dash hideous. There's a few cut lines in it, but you know...
They're not even cut lines. They're crevasses. It looks like you'd roll marbles around there. Remember that commercial, the Honda commercial with the marbles, or was that a Lexus commercial?
That was a Lexus commercial.
Yeah. You could do that on the dash, and it would just ride right along those grooves. It would never fly out.
You know, I don't find it offensive. I see what you're saying, but...
I look at it thinking, what the heck is wrong with you people? What is this? This is terrible.
The materials, I think, are maybe not... They're certainly not the top of its class, but they're good, and, you know...
What's wrong with you speaking ill of Ford?
I know. You can't say that about Ford. Come on, all the money they've been funneling to us.
I had lunch with Shermer and Hespin one time, and I was talking to him about that, and the answer was, wait till you see the 11 Edge. I think that's their way of agreeing with me. So when they say, wait till you see the 011, and that's the constant automaker response to everything. But having driven the Flex, I believe...
Wait till next year.
Right. Yeah. Having driven the Flex, if it's anywhere near the Flex, heck, if they just removed the Flex interior and put it into the Edge, I would just be so happy.
I like both interiors, and I don't have a problem with the dash. I think the materials, you know, there's some hard surfaces where you might like a soft touch feel, like on the dash panel. But you know what? It's low luster. It looks nice. It's a nice design. The panel gaps and stuff are good. Nothing buzzes. Nothing rattles.
It's solid and everything. But it's like equating it to football. Like the Flex is like an 80-yard touchdown pass, and the Edge is like a false start.
Yeah, except for sales-wise, it's reversed, thank you.
Yeah, lately nothing selling, so yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, the Ford fan club continues. I have an MKZ right now, and it just got in the driveway. I drove it all of 7 miles so far. I hit the golf range with it. Yeah, I like the seats, I could tell you that to start with.
Ford seats have really come a long way. They're really good.
In the what is it? You call it the glass paint job? What is it called, Sam?
It's called tuxedo black.
Yeah, it's got glass flex in it, or glass
beads in the paint.
It's the same thing that makes the highway stripes light up at night.
My 6-year-old twin daughters were in awe with this paint job. I think it looks pretty cool, but they liked it a lot more than I did. But I'll let you guys know more about it next week. But let's move on to a couple things that are in the news. First of all, the Obama administration has basically upped the ante on fuel economy. Sam, basically, I'll let you handle this one since you probably already wrote a post about it today. Is it 42 miles per gallon for cars by 2016 and trucks at 26?
Effectively, yeah. I mean, basically, the fight over California's attempt to get a waiver for their CO2 emission standards is now over because the federal government is going to adopt the same standards that California has been pushing for the last several years. And what they're doing is, rather than explicitly saying you have to get a certain number of miles per gallon, they're going to say you have to emit less than some number of grams per mile of carbon dioxide. And since carbon dioxide is directly related to how much fuel you burn, it goes back to miles per gallon. And it amounts to equivalent of, yeah, like you said, 42 miles per gallon for cars and 26 for trucks. And like the standard that was the draft corporate average fuel economy standard that came out about a year ago before the change in administration, this one is based on the vehicle footprint. So basically larger vehicles, the footprint being the area between the four wheels. So the wheelbase times the track, and the larger the vehicle, the lower the lower the mileage standard it has to meet. So big trucks won't have to, you won't see, you know, Ford F-150s and Silverados trying to get 26 or 28 miles per gallon. But smaller trucks will have to do that. And it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out, you know, to see if car makers end up basically making their vehicles bigger to compensate so that they don't have to meet the same standard. Because, you know, if you stretch the wheelbase 4 inches, all of a sudden you don't have to get quite as much mileage, even though the overall vehicle size might be the same.
But is there like an overall balance that each automaker has to hit, or is it just, hey, if you make only big cars, then you're covered?
They're actually going to set a standard for every vehicle and for every automaker that they have to hit by that time frame. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's based on the sales, and you know, if they end up selling more of some other vehicle, you know, it's still not entirely clear exactly how they're going to make adjustments along the way.
All right, because I could see, like, for example, the Cruise hitting 42 miles per gallon as a C-Class out of the box.
Yeah.
At least in with the 1.4 turbo, and that's coming next year.
Right.
And the same for, and I'm sure the Civic's going to be in the same boat, and you're going to, you know, Turbo's going to be in the same boat when they downsize the engines, though you haven't heard as much about the Civic and the Corolla, but I'm sure it's coming. They're just a little bit more tight-lipped about it. So, I mean, is it a mid? I'm very interested to see more information on this, because a mid-size sedan without hybrid power or whatever, getting 42 is going to be extremely tough.
Well, not necessarily, with the example of Ford, you know, they've got their EcoBoost engines coming. There's a 1.6 liter EcoBoost engine that goes into production in the UK late this year. And they're gonna add it next year to the next gen Focus, mm-hmm. and that could easily go into the Fusion as well.
Yeah, you know, it will.
I mean, they've shown it in three concepts so far this year, and you know, that's 180 horsepower engine, you know, from a 1.6 liter turbo direct injected four cylinder, which is about the same power they get now with the 2.5.
It's better, and it'll have better torque.
And, you know, if they combine that with the dual clutch transmission and automatic start stop, which they've said they will, you know, that's a car that, you know, mid-sized sedan that could easily get, you know, 40 miles per gallon.
Right.
But you're throwing the kitchen, a hybrid drive.
You're throwing the kitchen sink at it and getting close.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, they're using turbochargers as a way to kind of give you respectable performance from a smaller engine package, but it just strikes me as kind of like a shell game, or a, you know, something that's kind of done with mirrors when you think about it, because a turbocharged drivetrain, it's all directly related to how it's driven. So it may get 42
kind of drive
on its, right. So, but I mean, it'll get 42 on its test loop, and then you drive it like an animal, it's going to get significantly less, a larger proportion difference between that and a naturally aspirated power plant. So,
in the case of some of these new engines, it's not necessarily going to be that huge a difference there. In fact, it probably won't be that much, because with these DI turbocharged engines, they make so much low-end torque that you actually don't have to drive them very hard. They make much more low-end torque than a normally aspirated, slightly larger displacement engine. That, so you can drive it easier and still get the same kind of performance.
Yeah, they do run much higher compression ratios because of the cooling effect of DI too. So,
right,
I can see some of that efficiency gain. It strikes me as quite an ambitious
standard. It's not going to be easy. There is going to have to be a shift towards smaller vehicles, regardless of the footprint requirements, in order to hit that standard.
I think we also, when we say smaller vehicles to hit the standard, we mean smaller, more expensive vehicles, because they are going to have to...
Well, yeah, the more expensive is a given.
They're going to have to, in some way get lighter, which means more exotic materials. None of it's impossible except for the price point, I think.
Right, but the important thing to note is it's just over one vehicle cycle away. So basically,
it's less than a vehicle cycle.
Right now, 5 to 7 years.
Well,
and for
2016 is just over one vehicle cycle.
Right, and most vehicles nowadays are 5 year cycles. Some of the luxury vehicles get away with seven, like BMW, for example. They're on a 7 year or 8 year cycle. So,
the cars that are launching 2009, 2010. They'll just be getting redesigned. Most of them will just be getting redesigned. So
they'll hit the refresh.
Yeah. Right. And they usually, like, for example, with the Malibu, they'll run the Malibu out, for the 2008 model year, and then they'll take a year to just make some money on that platform, and then they get back to work. Because it probably takes 36 months to get the new platform together. And when I say take a break, that means work on the refresh, but not on the overhaul until... You're in some cases it's even 24 months away. They start going gangbusters, and as more companies go to global platforms, it's going to be closer to 24 all the way around. So sometime around the next model cycle, they're going to be close to being right at the threshold with models. So they're going to have to plan for this absolutely right now.
Well, what's the penalty if they're not?
Lots of fines.
Yeah, the fines will add up so fast. That's
Wait a minute. The lots of fines, and they're going to be able to pay them with what? Their bailout money?
Well,
that's
a good question.
I mean, how do you get blood from a stone?
But it's not just GM and Chrysler. It's everybody. This is Toyota. Yeah. This is Honda.
That's the fundamental problem, though, with any of these fuel economy standards, is that unless you do something on the flip side to generate demand for more efficient vehicles, there's going to be a problem for the automakers, for all automakers. There needs to be some stimulus for people to buy smaller, more efficient vehicles, which basically means higher fuel prices.
Well, we've seen that start to ratchet up over the last however many weeks, 6 weeks or so. It's been steadily increasing.
And the past week or so, it's started to fall back down again as world oil prices dip back down.
Right, but I think the oils, it seems to be stabilized, but every time we have a good day in the market, it goes up $2. So that tells me when the market's back up to close to where it was before all hell broke loose, that means oil's going to be back to $80 a barrel. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if that happened by next year at this time. So, I mean, there will be some sort of incentive, and you got to think by 2016, it's going to start getting close to $4 a gallon again. Even if we're lucky, it'll be $4 a gallon, and if we're not, it's going to be more. So
maybe it's a preemptive move. And look, we can sit here and say, oh, it's crazy, it's nuts, it's not going to happen, and whatever, and be quite, the naysayer. But on the other hand, when do you implement some kind of standard like that? Yes, it's a tough standard. But
now here's a question. I didn't read it all, I'll be honest. Are they going to get credits if they, for example, if the new Camry hybrid gets 60 miles per gallon, is that going to be a credit against the other hybrid based on how many
Cafe?
Based on how many of the other non-hybrids that they, like, if say if they they sold 200,000 hybrid Camrys at 60 miles per gallon, and there was a gasoline hybrid or gasoline Camry at 30 miles per gallon, are they going to get credits if they, you know, for example, they both sold 200,000 of each?
I haven't seen the final wording of the rules. In fact, I don't know that it's been written.
I don't think it has.
They're not making an announcement till tomorrow,
right?
So it's not clear how that's going to work. There probably will be some mechanism for credits. In the past, the way it's worked is automakers got credits for exceeding the fleet average. You know, so if they, if the fleet average was 26 miles per gallon for their, for their entire fleet, and they got 20, and their fleet got 28, so they were 2 miles per gallon over, they would get credits for that, which they could apply in future years if they fell short of the fleet average. And for a time in the late 1980s and early 90s, most of the automakers were, in fact, exceeding the CAFE threshold and earning credits, which they ended up using later in the 90s when they started falling short.
With SUVs.
Yeah.
And then they did things like build
they had
PT.
To make money some way, you know.
They built the PT Cruiser and called it a truck, and it got 26 miles per gallon. And that.
Well, and that's exactly why it got classified as a truck.
Right.
Because they used it to average out against the Rams.
Right, because the Rams was getting a new Hemi in the, for 2002, and that was the next year.
But see, all that kind of inside baseball really takes the teeth right out of it. That and cap and trade and just, you know what? Make it a standard, you know, make it clearly defined, easily understood. If you do not X, then you will Y.
Yeah, and we're talking government regulations here. Come
right,
on.
I
need to make it easily understood.
In any
Have you ever tried to read one of these things?
Any corporation does that stuff, too. I mean, I see it in every walk of life. There's always some sort of shell game going on at all times. So
It just makes it so ineffective, because then the energy goes into how do we beat this versus just, you know, how do we get it done.
Hey, you need to have good engineers that can beat it, and you need good minds that can work around it too. I mean, simultaneous paths right there. But alright, let's move on to the next item. I wanted to talk about Jeremy Clarkson from Top Gear fame. Recently did a review of the Honda Insight. And our own Sam has said basically that the Insight drives better than the Prius, but the Prius is much improved. You just said that last week.
Right. Well, saying the Insight drives better than the Prius is kind of damning with faint praise. I mean,
what I actually said was that it drives very much like a Honda Fit. And
okay, you know, so that's praise.
As entertaining a guy as Clarkson is, he is absolutely completely dead wrong on this, and he's full of shit. Yeah, he hates all hybrids, period. It doesn't matter how good or bad they might be.
Let's rehash what he said, actually, Sam. Basically, he called it called the Insight biblically terrible, which, I mean, that's like floods and famine. And he basically, he made like a bazillion really clever jokes, and they were all very funny. I was cracking up listening to it, but basically...
That's Clarkson's shtick, though, is... Yeah, it's not about whether he's right or wrong about what he writes about. It's is he entertaining in the way he writes about it?
Well, you got to remember though.
Yeah, that's what he.
Right, you hit the nail on the head, because his stock and trade is entertainment. He's an entertainer. He's a commentator, I suppose, and so he comes at it with some level of knowledge. But in the end, Top Gear is merely entertainment. And
right, but I mean,
entertainment.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I wouldn't trade it for anything. But when it comes to these written reviews that he did, if he's literally just doing it for entertainment, like, doesn't he lose some credibility in the wash?
Well, because it's his opinion. You know, if he doesn't like the Insight, if he thinks it's biblically terrible, hey, fine, whatever. But it's the same reason why people sometimes comment on the podcast and say, oh, you guys are just, making these statements to stir things up. Well, sort of, not really, but it'd be really boring if he just said, oh, the Insight, it's wonderful. It's the next best thing since, dental surgery for British people. So, I mean, it's... you got to take it with a grain of salt, I suppose.
I totally agree. That the Insight is certainly no drag racer. It's a little slow, but when you get it on a twisty road, it's a lot of fun to drive.
it's a little slow. It still spanks like the CRX that was their sports car back in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much faster than that car. It's not even funny. So, you know, slow is relative.
I have to read this because it's still funny. It says, the Honda's petrol engine is a much-shaved, built-for-economy, low-friction 1.3 that at full chat makes a noise worse than someone else's crying baby on an airliner. It's worse than the sound...
No, see, there, he's completely wrong.
It's worse than the sound of your parachute failing to open. Really, to get an idea of how awful it is, you'd have to sit a dog on a ham slicer. I laugh for 10 minutes from that one.
Yeah, he's funny. It's the first car I've ever considered crashing into a tree on purpose, so I didn't have to drive it anymore. I mean, he's funny. That's his point. He's funny.
And I think he's also lying there, because I'm pretty sure that he considered the same thing when he drove the little G-Wiz electric car.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
he had a lot of fun with that one, too.
Well, you know, they're in an interesting position because they don't have to answer so much to any kind of advertisers, like any U.S.-based media besides public television, which, or public, you know, public broadcasting, which also, you know, as much as they want to say it's not, you know, supported by advertisers, underwriting is advertising. So they can say things with more impunity.
In the case of this review, though, you know, Clarkson writes his reviews in the Times, which, you know, is not part of the BBC.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
It does have advertisers.
Hey, I'm looking at the site.
That doesn't stop him from saying things with impunity.
Here's another good one. It says, in engineering terms, you really can't have brilliant apart from... I mean, the Titanic was brilliant apart from its crappy rudder.
I mean, what's he saying about the Titanic rudder? That the rudder had nothing to do with the Titanic's accident.
When
it was the grate of steel, and it hit an iceberg, and the crappy grate of steel shattered, and... He needs to go back and study.
I don't really know what happened to the Titanic, Dan, but it's
still funny. Let's not confuse the facts with Jeremy Clarkson, you know.
But in this case, I would actually...
Let's not confuse the Autoblog podcast with a legitimate piece of media.
All right.
Notice how
something.
I fizzled?
And moving on.
All right, let's move on.
Shall we get into those reader questions, Chris?
Absolutely.
We've already burned a half an hour. Come on.
You think it's time? All right.
Yeah.
Got some great questions.
Since this was supposed to be an all Q&A show, I thought.
Hey, but you know what? Yeah. They like hour-long podcasts, and the people have spoken, and we're listening. All right. Hey, guys. Love the podcast. It's fantastic. Thanks. He was just curious, what 5 cars would each of you want to see from the D3, that means the Detroit 3, that should be made? For example, an EV Cruise instead of the Volt, flex-based Meta 1, the Meta 1 was based off of the Freestyle, something like that, 300 Hybrid, maybe the Hornet, something that we saw 500 years ago. His name is not given, so I will start with you, Dan.
Hakeem, I believe. With me? I think the one that springs most immediately to mind is I want to see a Chrysler 200C replacing the Sebring.
Yesterday.
Right away.
Yeah, like 6 months ago, right? Okay, well, give me another one.
I want to see a Fusion with the manual transmission hooked up to either of the V6s.
That's a good one. Okay, give me another one. DS for 5, man. From each of us.
Okay,
5 each.
Hakeem rules, man.
So it says Detroit 3.
Yep.
Think
about anything from GM you'd like to see. I can think of a bazillion. Just think of engine combinations.
I want to see the Malibu with the 4-cylinder and a 5-speed as well, or a 6-speed. You know, manual. See, I like my manual transmissions. So I want to see that combo make a comeback on basically everything.
Bad chance of that happening.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, federalizing and certifying.
Just trying to get Americans to buy something with a manual clutch.
Yeah. Boy. 5 cars should be.
So what would you pick? I'm up to three.
All right. Let's see. I'd take the Fusion with a 1.6 liter EcoBoost, the dual clutch gearbox, and auto start stop. Because, like I said, that one would give you mileage comparable to the
hybrid. Oh, I got one.
At a much lower cost.
All right, I got one.
Sam starts talking, I knew that was going to happen.
The current Focus, as much as people like to hate it, I want to see that with an EcoBoost. That would be a hell of a lot of fun, because it's light.
Absolutely.
And it's cheap, so you could put a more expensive powertrain in it and not affect the price too much.
Man, Ford should pay us for this podcast. We are,
especially since the powertrain.
That would get you the same, or actually probably better power than the old SVT Focus had.
Yeah, and I mean,
that at 170. Yeah,
that car's been amortized for how long now? I mean, come on.
About 32 years, I think.
Yeah. It's a Pinto underneath.
All right, Sam, give me another one.
Let's see. How about a Mustang with the 3.5 EcoBoost, which I'm pretty sure that one's going to be arriving with the next 18 months or so. Because I've driven that EcoBoost in several different vehicles now, and that is an amazing engine. Let's see. How about a Camaro that's about 600 pounds lighter with that with the 3.6 DI V6 in it?
See, the one. Then I was hoping you didn't say it, but I want the Solstice Coupe engine, the 290 horsepower 2 liter turbo in the Camaro.
Isn't it a 260?
Yeah, it's 260.
It got bumped in the coupe.
No, it didn't.
I think with one of the stage upgrades for the the Cobalt SS. So maybe in the coupe
they could kick up.
You could definitely
juice.
Get that engine up to 300.
Yeah, give me 300 horsepower Camaro with a 4-cylinder turbo. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, put that engine in the Malibu.
600 pounds less power or less poundage.
In the Camaro.
Yeah, in the Camaro. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just too heavy.
You know, going the Malibu route again, that EcoBoost, the Ecotec with the turbo, that 260 horse motor, put that in the Malibu. That would be a hell of a lot of fun.
Do you guys sense a theme developing here?
I like my mid-sized sedans that just, you know, are good performers, and I think that, you know, Malibu SS, who could be wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing.
And as the family guy that likes the crossovers, I used to buy Explorers, and I would love to have an Explorer America concept as an actual vehicle with a 2-liter turbo in 26, 27 miles per gallon.
Well, the Explorer is moving to the Flex platform, so it's
right.
Actually,
it's going to be car-based. It's going to be car-based crossover
next year. So,
which is really smart. So,
yeah. Let's see what else.
I want to see a pickup truck that's again, lighter, more fuel efficient, with a smaller engine.
How about the Duramax?
I want a midsize station wagon with a 2-liter diesel and a 6-speed manual gearbox.
You know, we're all coming up with stuff that they're just never going to build.
What would we want to see? Some of the ones we've said they are going to build.
I mean, you said you wanted the 200C yesterday, and I just looked back at the news yesterday, and it's not there. So,
yeah, that's true.
We're all stabbing in the dark here.
That's true.
I would like to see. He said the Hornet as an example, and I thought as far as the B class cars, I like the design of the Hornet better than I like the Fiesta. I thought it was the coolest. I loved it.
Hey, you could put a Hornet body on a Fiat 500.
Wouldn't it be a little
500
bigger?
Platform? No reason.
So
you
I think
do
that's one of the things that we kind of left off. We really went right at a lot of production vehicle engine powertrain combinations, but we didn't really pick up on you know, it'd be really cool to actually see the Chevy Beat go into production.
Well, the Beat is going into production.
It is. They've only announced the Spark, right?
I thought it wasn't.
Well, the Spark is the Beat.
But the Beat looked different.
It's a 4-door version of the Beat.
I'm so confused.
I thought the Beat was the orange one.
No, the Beat was green. The Beat was the green one.
Oh, the orange one was
the Trax.
That one blew.
Thanks.
The orange one was the Trax, and the matte purple one was the Jazz.
The Jazz, yeah.
Yeah, no, the Trax is the one that blew, and I'm like, what? You went that one? Because that one blew. I'm sure of it.
I think we're missing all those small segment vehicles that may be part of what they need to meet these new fuel economy standards if they get teed off tomorrow.
Well, that's why they're bringing the Spark over here.
Yeah. I just want every small car to drive like it's light on its feet and handle really sharply. And it doesn't have to be a small car. Any car. I just want any car to just drive like it should.
I want them to bring back the El Camino.
Every car should drive like it should, Dan.
That's a good point.
And I say drive like it should, meaning how God and I intend vehicles to drive.
Is there a distinction there?
Not so much. Well, I'm not a conservative like I've been accused of being.
No, you're definitely not. You're just a grumpy
Democrat.
That's
Alex's job on the auto blog.
Yeah, exactly. So God is kind of like who? But anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, and I think the other one that I would pick is, and I think it's coming, but I don't know, is the 2011 Astra in Buick form, because it looked pretty hot to me. So
yeah, that's a heck of a nice car. It
surprised me with the powertrain, but I definitely want to see that.
Well, if it does show up, it'll probably have the same 1.4 turbo that's going in the Cruze.
Take it. I'll take it, man. That's a great idea. What is it, 140 horsepower, 40-plus miles per gallon? That sounds good to me. All right, next one. Michael, 17-year-old high school student, and he's looking into getting into an older sports car. He wants to fix it up with the help of a local mechanic, which he knows well. And he's wondering what our suggestion is to look for. So he's looked at some old 911s and an E30 M3. What would you guys suggest? Now, I want to warn you, as a 17-year-old, and this is something a friend of mine... Do you guys remember the Conquest?
Yes.
My buddy...
That's a money pit.
My buddy bought the Conquest, and I told him, I said, I read on Car and Driver, and I remember reading this, that this thing costs a lot of money to fix. And it sounds great, and I'm looking at the tires, and they're a little bald. I'm like, this is going to cost you a fortune every which way. Didn't listen to me, and he bought it anyway. And the car was affordable, but it was a money pit. And 911s and E30s are going to cost
anything German is going to be a money pit.
Well, what, though? The E30 is not that bad. An E30 M3 is a whole different stripe, but a regular E30, not that bad. And I would suggest something like a 318 or a 325, because the 325 is obviously going to have more performance. 318 is probably going to be easier to find. But an E30 M3 is such a rare bird, and anyone you're going to find that you can afford is going to be probably beat up. They're a homologation special. They're not like the later M3s. So they've got a lot of stuff in them that's made out of unobtainium at this point. They're not a common car. They're very special. And so if you want to do one right, it's going to cost you a lot of money. If you want to find one in good shape, it's going to cost you a lot of money, because trust me, I bought a $500 car when I was a little older than him, and there's really no such thing. I put a lot of work into it. I I'm more than happy to get out there and spin the wrenches, but buy the best car you can afford that's in what you want. An E30 is a good choice, because it's not that expensive to maintain, actually, if you're going to do some of the work yourself. It's very common parts. It's K-Jetronic, I think, or LH, some flavor of Bosch fuel injection. So it's really, the parts are pretty cheap for that kind of stuff. Suspension bushings and stuff may run you a little bit, but in general, it's not that expensive. It's just an old car at this point.
Yeah, and then the other thing, and I hate to sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but a lot of these older cars, like an old 911, there's no such thing as trash control on these things, and if you're not experienced, don't get one of these cars.
That's what I was just going to get into. And both of those cars, the E30 and the 911, are tricky cars to drive fast.
That's true. And the E30s have that.
Neither one of them is something that I would really want to see a 17-year-old get behind the wheel.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Sam. Yeah. I swear to God.
If what I would recommend, is buy something,
I got it.
Cheap. Maybe like an old Miata or something like that, to really hone your skills, and go spend a couple of grand on a driving school, on a good driving school, like Bondurant, Skip Barber, whatever, and go spend a week there, really learn your skills, and then take a cheap Miata or, an old Integra or something like that. I mean, that would be a good one. And go out, spend your weekends, doing the autocrosses, do the track days, and, thrash the car around on the track and really hone your skills and learn how to control the car. And then you know, when you're, you know, 22, 23, and you've really got that stuff nailed down, then go buy an E30 or a 911.
And you'll find yourself in a little bit better financial situation as well. Yeah. And it,
oh, exactly. I forgot all about that. You won't be spinning off the track at the third corner.
Yeah.
Right.
And I forgot all about that E30 Widowmaker rear suspension with the, what is it, like the semi-trailing arms or something? And 911s, yeah, the older 911s are definitely known for their, you know, lift throttle oversteer and just you got to be careful with the rear engine cars. The 911 is just wrong in many ways for 17-year-old. First of all, that is the definition of a money pit. They're just... It's an air-cooled engine. It's, you know, not like you're going to be able to take it anywhere but a specialist for service.
Hey, your mechanic friend's probably going to be over his head right away, or...
Yeah, if your buddies are used to, like, you know, Camaros and stuff, they're going to look... They're going to spend 20 minutes trying to find the oil filter. You know, it's just... Yeah. It's a different car.
And even if he's good... And if he could be a fantastic mechanic, but this is a different animal. And my suggestion to you is to... Go out the next time it snows and pick any rear-wheel drive pickup truck and see how well you do. And I guarantee you're going to end up looking the other way. You know, rear drive, no four-wheel drive.
But I mean, your
headlights are going to be pointing the wrong way within the first 5 minutes. And that's what it's going to be like driving a 911 on dry pavement from 1987. So
no, it's not that bad. It's got 60% of its weight over the rear wheels.
It's not that bad, but when you're 17-year-old, but when you're pushing it hard on the track, it is nasty.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it's not forgiving. If you end up in the middle of a turn too hot, you are done.
I would say definitely get an old. Like an old Civic or an Integra that's, you know, had some suspension work done on it.
I got it.
Or a Miata.
Fox, you know, body Mustang.
Money. He's not going to get a Mustang. Yeah. You can just tell by...
Fox body. Come
look
on.
What he's, dirt look cheap. What he's if picking. You want, if, I, I'm well, telling you right if, now, he's rolling his eyes at Mustang.
If you want something rare, go with another Fox body car. An LTD LX. Super rare. It's got the Mustang GT powertrain in it. It's a special car.
You're right.
It's a hell of a car. You can find a good one for short dollars. You can make your own. There's a lot of Fox body vehicles to choose from. You could build up an LSC.
Or you can get a 1985 pretty nice. Monte Carlo and you could put 20-inch rims on it. That sounds like fun.
He's not going to do it.
I don't think that's what this guy's looking
for. He's not
going to
do a Fox body Mustang or a Fox body anything else either.
You mentioned Miatas. What's much cheaper? You know, what's much cheaper than a Miata? Nothing. But a Fox body Mustang's pretty close.
Okay, but the Miata's a great handling car, and it's got
a Fox body Mustang can be a great handling car.
Listen, he's thinking I want girls. He's 17. He's thinking girls one, no, speed
he
two.
Said he wants
he's
a track
not going
to
attract girls with a Miata. I'm sorry. It's just... I don't know.
He didn't say he wanted a track car. He's nothing about track cars. He said he wants an older sports car. He's thinking about... Look, when you're 17, everything you do is geared towards getting girls. Everything. Even when you're something that you really like cars.
Hmm.
So,
I was just trying to get my driver's license at that point.
You had low expectations. This guy's... Mustang. Look at... Were your expectations E30 M3 when you were 17? Dan?
No, I was driving the Granada wagon.
He's got expectations here, so I'm just guessing.
Yeah,
but
and I think he's got unrealistic expectations.
Maybe I mean we don't know his economic situation. We don't know anything about him, but he didn't really give us a price tag, which is mistake numero uno. So my guess is whatever you have, if you have like a $10,000 limit, buy a $5,000 car. That's what I'm thinking.
And put the rest of the money towards a driving school.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, too, like, I'm just trying to think of older vehicles that are easy to maintain, because if you want to go for something that's going to be a pain in your ass all the way around, you could get the Diamond Stars, which are going to be more difficult. They're still not hard, really, but they're just, you know, they're tightly packaged. Versus, you know, something like the Miata, which it actually is easy to service. You don't want to be learning on something that's such a pain.
I love the Miata as an example. It's perfect. It drives.
It is a great driving car. You know what I don't like about the Miata? It's not a coupe. And you know, so if you want a convertible, and it's there's nothing to not recommend it. It's a great choice.
All right, let's move on to the next question. This guy says he listens to the podcast every week, and it's a great way to stay up with what's happening in the automotive industry, and he generally finds himself agreeing with Dan. So strike
yeah,
one.
Yeah, he's listening to the wrong podcast. It must be my evil twin. we talk about the what industry?
Okay, his fiance is going to be attending grad school in the fall, and he's looking for a new car. Her current car is a Sentra 96, and it's on its last legs. The mom is willing to buy her a new car as a graduation gift, as long as it's $16,000 or less. That's a pretty good car you can get with that. The question slash problem is, the car she really wants is an MK5, possibly MK6 VW Golf. She and I are living in Germany right now, and she's fallen in love with them, but she listens to the Autoblog podcast, too. And I bet she's hot, because she listens to the podcast. I'm just saying, she's probably hot. All right, your opinions on the reliability, according to Consumer Guide, is scaring away from the car. You guys have basically talked her into a Honda Fit, Sam, because although she dislikes the look, she knows it will be reliable and it's cheap. She also seen the Polo and the Fiesta, and I've told her that both of them will be coming to the States. She likes the Polo and is lukewarm on the Ford. What's your advice?
Well, the Fiesta is definitely coming here at the end of the year, but you know, she said she doesn't like the looks. The Polo is believed to be coming to the U.S. Probably late 2010 or 2011. Yeah. But Volkswagen still hasn't officially confirmed that. So, you know, it may or may not ever arrive here. So, you know, you can't really count on that one. The Golf, you know, getting a Golf for under 16 grand, certainly not a new one, is going to be tough.
Yeah, but that's not going to be that old of one for 16.
Yeah, I mean, you could get a used one, you know, a couple years old for under 16 grand. So,
which means that some other sucker has taken the bath on it and fixed all the crap if you get a certified pre-owned.
Well, can you get a good warranty on the certified pre-owned?
Yeah, I think it's like a year or something. I mean,
you can buy an aftermarket warranty.
Yeah. You know, just because it's gone through the warranty period and had all that stuff fixed doesn't mean it will remain fixed.
No.
As I have learned so expensively. You know, another one to consider is a Focus, or Cobalt. Cobalt's a pretty decent car for not a lot of money.
Yeah, but I think if you've got somebody who's really interested in the Golf, it's going to be difficult for them to find something to love just sitting in a Cobalt. Not that it's not a good car. It is. It's a really good car, but the Golf is just... the Golf is the class of that field. And if you really want a Golf, I don't think there's... You know, it's one of those things. It's an emotional purchase. So if that's what she's set on, try it. Just shop carefully.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a fun car to drive.
Yeah, get a $15,000 one and spend the extra $1,000 on the warranty. There you go.
Yeah.
get the extended warranty on it, because the second problem is, we've touched on this before, is servicing them is a fortune. I mean, because there is a dearth of certified Volkswagen techs, and they command a premium versus the run-of-the-mill Chrysler tech.
Well, the thing with...
Of course, if you're here in the Ann Arbor area, I've found a good one. So. It's actually pretty reasonable.
And how many times have you seen them?
A lot.
More times than I care to remember.
Maybe he's even better than you think. All right.
The thing with European ownership, I've found, is you need to find a specialist. Because even the dealer service departments, they're usually good, but the specialist will take better care of you. The dealer service departments, and this doesn't necessarily go for just European brands, but they tend to have an apathy towards you that a specialist won't. And the specialists really know your vehicle, and they take better care of their customers.
That's because dealers win on volume. They don't win satisfying the individual. Yeah, more
don't shop on labor rate alone. You know, but I mean, Volkswagens they got plenty of fans. There's plenty of support. There's lots of specialists everywhere for them. If that's what you really want, shop very carefully.
And I've said this a bazillion times. Mazda 3 hatchback, love it.
Mazda 3 is a good choice.
Yeah, that's another good choice.
Okay, and you can get the 17-inch rims. It's just a good looking car, and I love it in that dark charcoal gray.
How much does a used Mazda Speed 3 go for?
You don't want the Speed 3.
Okay.
They eat turbos.
Okay, this one's from Elliot in Alberta, Canada. We get a lot of questions from Canada, and we appreciate most of them. All right, his question is regarding the steering wheel shift buttons on the new PDK and SMG gearboxes. He notices that rather than the standard right upshift left downshift arrangement. The steering wheel shifter has two identical buttons on each side, each for pushing for upshift and pullback for downshift. As testers that have driven both, what do you and that's not me. What do you think of this layout, and why do you think the automakers move away from what I think would be a great ergonomic standard of right and left?
I have no idea why they've moved away from that. And I definitely prefer having, you know, the one side be upshift and the other side be downshift. I don't like the push-pull mechanism, but that seems to be the way everybody's going. I think part of it is, you know, that they probably feel that it's more, that it's easier for people to get used to, you know, always pushing for a downshift and pulling towards you for an upshift, as opposed to trying to remember which side is the up and which side is down.
They think people are stupid. And, you know,
and there's plenty of evidence to back that assessment up.
Yes, largely that's a safe assumption. I got to say, steering wheel buttons for the transmission, I generally despise. If I want to shift my own gears, I'll drive a manual. Now, PDK and SMG, they're automated manuals, so that's a little different. So they really should have proper paddles.
They're both dual clutch.
The new SMG
is a dual clutch transmission. Yeah.
And
they're an automated preselector, which, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Since I didn't have an opinion on it, and I knew you guys would have something, but I still wanted to bring something to the table, so I asked Michael Harley from Autoblog to pitch in with a comment of his own, because he uses cars on PDK? The track a lot. So I figured, you know, that would be a good way to differentiate. And he said, here's his answer. Most manufacturers, BMW and Porsche included, have simplified, in quotes, the paddle shifting for consumers with identical buttons on each side of the wheel. First, most buyers are more familiar with this arrangement. Porsche Tiptronic, for example, has used this for a while, and they didn't want to confuse their customers when they introduced the PDK. Second, it's much easier in day-to-day driving when you can accomplish both up and down shifts with one hand. On a track, with both hands on the wheel, the F1 style is preferred. As the technology is still relatively new, the consumer automotive market, there hasn't been really a standard yet. In fact, consumers are still very much split over which system they prefer. That's Mike's answer.
Good points. I didn't think about the using it with one hand, because if you're driving, talking on your phone, shaving, drinking a latte, you're going to leave it in automatic mode anyway, so.
Yeah, I mean, and for most drivers, you know, having either hand on the steering wheel is optional.
Yeah. So how do I shift with my knees?
The knees are an effective steering device.
Love it. Okay, let's move on to the next question. This is from Patrick. Oh, and by the way, Elliot from Alberta wanted to mention that we are his first bookmark, and that he is a Taurus show nut. His parents bought a red one new in 1989, and he cried when they traded in for an Explorer years later. And he cried, yet the fact of the matter is they probably traded in for an Explorer. Him and his siblings were part of the reason why they got the Explorer instead of the Taurus. But, all right, next guy is Patrick. He appreciates the podcast, and Patrick, we appreciate your sentiment. I found out about a car pricing website called TrueCar.com, and seems easy to use and seems to provide good data. Do you have any experience with it? He's looking for a new or lightly used sedan that looks like that has the looks and performance of the Fusion and the Chevy Malibu. There are good options for the Ford, both used in the $10,000 to $12,000 range for a $4,000 model with 25,000 miles on it. The Chevy, not so much, because it's new for 2008. I only like the new body style, and there are a few used ones on the market. The new car price is close to $20,000, where I can get the Ford for about $17,000. Granted, the cost of the automatic transmission, which I don't really want, is factored into the Chevy's price, but he doesn't account for the $3,000 price difference. Is he missing something, or is the Chevy really that much of a price disadvantage? Dan, I'll let you start.
I have no experience with the website. I haven't been out there shopping for Malibus, but from what I've heard and believe to be the case, the Malibu is actually not selling as cheaply as the Fusion. you're probably going to be able to find a deal on both. I think the Fusion deal is going to be better than the Malibu, and that's partly because I think the Malibu is a little bit newer on GM dealer lots.
Yeah, as far as the used ones, you can't get, and I'm sure you're not interested in getting a 2007 or older Malibu.
And, you know, it's really like the first time they've had a competitive Malibu since, well, since the model debuted back in the 60s.
But it is competitive now, but the fact is, like, when the,
right,
when
that's the what I mean. Now is the first, the dealers are going to try to hang on right. to it and get as much as they
when
can.
When the 2010 Fusion came along, that made the last generation Fusion that much cheaper. So any
and there's nothing wrong with that last generation.
Right, and it's and like you said, but you mentioned the manual, hard to find. They didn't make very many of them. I think less than 5% of them are manual. So
I think that goes for anybody who makes a manual transmission. They probably get less than 5% takers, unless it's a real niche vehicle.
That's why GM didn't even bother offering a manual on the
Malibu. Because they're gonna have people like us complaining and. I'm not buying a new car anyway, so then they know that.
Well, that and, so that and the fact that people are going to want to pay less for the manual one if they have to do the engineering cost for something that they're not going to do very many of, doesn't not really very cost advantage to GM anywhere there. So, well, if you have to have the manual, then I think your only choice is the Fusion. So you can get the manual with the SEL, or is it just with the SE?
You can get it in the...
I think you can get it with the S.
And I think the SEL as well.
I think you can get it with the, you know, it's obviously going to be the four cylinder.
I know the one I tested was an SE. Let me see.
I haven't tested one with a manual. I've had Limiteds and SELs.
No, I guess you can't get it in the SEL.
But you can get an SE with the Sport package, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
So do that. All right. Let's see if we can get one more in here. This is from Luke Farlow. He also enjoys the podcast, and he wants us to keep up the great work, and we will. Again, another car purchase one. His dad is looking to. Oh, we already did this one. Shoot! I guess we're done with the podcast.
No, there's one. There is one that I noticed, I know we didn't answer it.
Is this from last? Week.
I wanted to get to it. Yeah, we didn't do this one here. He's anxiously awaiting his 2010
Ford Fusion Sport.
Fusion Sport. Ordered it 4+ weeks ago. It's from Tony. He's trading from a BMW 325 to a Ford Fusion. His reasons are he's tired of shifting. Wimp. the Beamer is aging poorly. Yes. Welcome to German engineering.
Here's the key. It says unresolved issues, i.e. I took it in, and then when I got it back, it still sucked, and I still had to pay.
Yeah. He wants a new car. I hear that. He loves sync, and I can understand that. This is what we were talking about earlier. He's a techie. The new sync nav travel services, which I was using in the Edge with the serious weather and all that stuff. It's super cool. You can't even get in the 325, all that stuff. And the 325 with anything close is going to be ridiculous. And the Fusion Sport has enough performance that, he feels it's worth it. So he's got a question. He's buying American, and he puts that in quotes, because the Fusion is built in Mexico, and he wants to know if that's better than buying a BMW that's built in Germany. In terms of, it's better than buying a BMW built in Germany. He wants to know if it's better than buying like a Toyota built in Kentucky, you know, with the foreign plants here. Does that help out our economy more than by buying the Ford than it does by buying a foreign brand?
And that's a complicated question.
I don't know.
There's definitely no simple answer to
right.
that
and,
one.
I'll take the first stab at that one. Go ahead and finish up.
Well, I was just going to say his he goes on to say, you know, the difficulty is determining the value of each part, trying to figure out where the car is really coming from. And, a lot of that information is on the Monroney, or at least some of it. You know, you get the final assembly and the majority of the part sources, so you can try to make an informed decision about where your car is actually being built and where the parts are sourced from. But I don't have a good answer for, you know, whether buying a Mexican-built Ford is better economically than buying a, you know, Kentucky-built Toyota other than the parent company is
right.
Here.
Right, and here's why it's complicated. First of all, buying a quote-unquote American car that's assembled in Mexico, like the Fusion, traditionally you'd say, okay, you know, it's actually developed and engineered here in Michigan, so that's where the big money is because you're dealing with suppliers, you're dealing with, you know, you're designing all the equipment, then most of it's being, you know, produced here in the States, and then it's shipped down to Mexico because a lot of that high-end manufacturing is only available here in the States still. Like in terms of like building stamps, I don't think they can't stamp those huge presses. They can't do that in Mexico in a lot of cases, and they probably can now, but traditionally they couldn't. And traditionally the Toyota Camry was mostly shipped over from overseas, and now it's made mostly in Kentucky and in Indiana. And now they've got the Toyota Technical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So
yeah, I mean the last three generations of Camry are pretty much unique to the U.S. market, and they've been developed almost entirely here in the U.S. at a tech center about 3 miles from my house. Right. It used to be a lot easier question to answer. You know, these days it's not, like you said. You know, there's a lot of American engineers working for Toyota, working for Honda, working for Nissan, working for even Hyundai, you know, who also have a tech center about 3 miles from here. So, you know, a lot of the development work and testing and everything else is going on here in the States and employing American engineers and technicians and test drivers and janitors and landscapers and everybody else, you know, all the other ancillary support staff. So, you know, I'd say at this point it almost doesn't
right.
matter.
And the one thing I would say is if you really want to assist the American automakers or like the company that builds the most American, you have to look at like overall percent content. And I think like Harbor Report and Ward's Automotive do like that content list. And usually, and I think this is still the case, the Detroit 3 still end up 1, 2, and 3 in terms of percentage of their vehicles that are made here in the States. The number's been getting closer, that and the American companies have gone down as the Japanese and Korean car makers have gone up, and they're closing the gap. But to this point, still, pound for pound, more American-built product is, as a percentage is happening from the Detroit automakers than, for example, Toyota. But so yeah, I mean, overall, and if you buy the Fusion,
you know, it depends on the specific product,
right? But if if you're buying the Fusion, yeah, it's made in Mexico. But the fact is, the bottom line profits, they go to the United States, and that right. enables them to build more other products that they could perhaps build in Michigan or in Ohio or some other place. So the bottom line profits from Toyota go to Japan. That's like I said, it's not an easy question to answer. And by the way, congratulations on your new car purchase.
Right. There's a lot of that. I guess the most important thing, again, is, you know, shop carefully, make an informed decision, do research, and there's nothing wrong with buying a Toyota that's built here if it's supporting the economy of your country is important to you. There's nothing wrong with buying a car that's, you know, been engineered by U.S.-based engineers and designed by U.S.-based designers like Toyota's Kalti Center. You know, look into what you're buying. You're spending quite a chunk of money, and
right.
You know, if it's important to you.
One last thing to throw in there, too, is traditionally over the last 40, 50 years, the U.S., Canadian, and to some degree the Mexican auto markets have generally been considered, you know, the domestic auto market.
Right.
And typically what has happened is even though the U.S.-based automakers have had factories in Canada and factories in Mexico, you know, what they often do is, you know, yeah, okay, they built, you know, Ford builds Fusions in Mexico and GM builds Impalas in Canada, you know, and they ship those to the U.S., but they also ship cars that are built here to those countries, you know, F-150s and you know, Mustangs that are built here, you know, get shipped to Canada and to Mexico. And, you know, what ends up happening is the overall balance, the overall proportion of, you know, the cars that they build in each of the three countries is roughly similar to the proportion of sales in those countries. So, you know, if 10% of their sales are in Canada, you know, roughly 10% of what they build comes from Canada. You know, so it pretty much balances out, at least when you're looking at, you know, the North American market.
All right.
That's a good answer. I was stunned. I mean, like, I couldn't say a word. It was so good. All right. Awesome podcast. Because of you guys sending in all your questions. We appreciate it. Always, podcast@autoblog.com. I love doing the question and answer one, because when we give ourselves more room, and we probably should have given even more time to it, but when we do that, it's usually the most satisfying. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I dig the question once.
Sam, you're no nut.
And it, you know, makes us think a little more too when we get questions from readers.
Well, they
explain
they
this
ask,
thinking.
They ask
to
different
me.
Questions than what we're used to thinking about, and it's good, right? It's like an exercise.
Yeah, anytime somebody asks me to pick a car, I'm stumped instantly.
No, you don't. You just say Fusion. Of course, I mean, get a Fusion.
Yeah, Ford. Are you listening? I'm looking for a vehicle for it. I want an Edge. I want somebody to take one of my Volvos off my hands, pay off the loan. I want an Edge for $15,000. I want to spend about $200 a month on an Edge, brand new Edge.
Can we get you anything else with that? Maybe some Patron and.
Nah, Patron, bleh. Nah, just an Edge. That's snow tires.
Oh, how about a $5 bottle of Opus 1? Wheels. How's that sound?
Hey, you know, might as well dream.
All right, guys.
If you get a dream,
yeah,
dream
absolutely.
Big.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Good night.
See ya.